This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Our Musical Future. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Each week at this time on this unique program, you get to hear the next generation of great classical musicians in performances of concerts, recitals, and special music events that happen at the top music schools throughout this country. Our roster this year of participating schools has grown. It will grow even further in the next few weeks. One of the schools we edited a number of years ago, and I'm so happy to have them back, is Temple University and the Boyer College of Music and Dance. Since 1884, when founder Reverend Russell Conwell began teaching students, Temple University has evolved into a comprehensive urban research and academic institution. Temple has a world-class reputation and an international presence with campuses in Philadelphia, Ambler, and Harrisburg in Pennsylvania, but also in Tokyo, Rome, and educational centers in Seoul, Beijing, London, Paris, and Mumbai. Temple's 17 schools and colleges, 9 campuses, hundreds of degree programs, and 35,000 students combine to create one of the nation's most comprehensive and diverse learning environments. And the Boyer College of Music and Dance is part of the Center for the Performing and Cinematic Arts at Temple University. Students at the Boyer College have the unique opportunity to interact with leading composers, conductors, educators, performers, and choreographers while experiencing a challenging and diverse academic curriculum. The Boyer faculty is recognized globally as leaders in their respective fields. Boyer alumni are ambassadors of artistic leadership and perform with major orchestras, opera, and dance companies, teach at schools and colleges, and work as professional music therapists, choreographers, and composers. The concert we'll hear took place at the Temple Performing Arts Center, which consists of the Boyer College of Music and Dance, School of Theater, Film, and Media Arts, the George and Joy Abbott Center for Musical Theater, and the Temple Performing Arts Center. Boyer is home to the 3-time Grammy-nominated Temple University Symphony Orchestra, award-winning jazz program, and research and scholarly advancements in music therapy, music theory, history, education, conducting, keyboard, voice, and dance. College also manages its own record label, BCM&D, Boyer College of Music and Dance Records, which has released more than 30 recordings. And tonight we'll feature the Temple University Symphony Orchestra as recorded back on October 5th. They are led by the artistic director and conductor of the Temple University Symphony Orchestra, Maestro Andreas Delfs, born in Flensburg, Germany. He began studying piano and music theory at the age of 5. He entered the Hamburg Conservatory, studied conducting with Christoph von Dohnányi, and at age 20, he was the youngest ever music director of the Hamburg University Orchestra. He then moved to New York, where he studied with George Mester and Sixten Ehrling at Juilliard and won the Bruno Walter Memorial Scholarship before completing his master's degree. He's worked with some of the most renowned musical soloists, Emmanuel Ax, Joshua Bell, Yo-Yo Ma, Renee Fleming, led some of the world's most noted ensembles in New York, London, Hong Kong, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Sydney, Taipei. He was the music director of the Milwaukee Symphony for 12 seasons. He also held posts leading the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra and the music director in Hanover, Germany. He's conducted numerous world premieres, has close links with many of today's living composers such as John Corigliano, Philip Glass, Roberto Sierra, and has made also a number of critically acclaimed recordings. He's going to lead the Temple University Symphony Orchestra in an all-Russian program. There are a number of opera overtures that are rip-roaring curtain raisers, imbued with infectious energy, high spirits. Amongst them are Mozart's overture to the Marriage Figaro, overtures by Rossini, Barber Seville, Semiramide, Smetana's overture to the Bartered Bride, Bernstein's Candide overture, and the one that will begin our program, Mikhail Glinka's overture to his opera Ruslan and Ludmilla. Along with the fast tempi, exhilarating rhythmic flow, another element these overtures all have in common is brilliant, coloristic orchestration. Throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, opera in Russia had not only adhered to French and Italian models, it consisted almost totally of works by actual French and Italian composers. There was no inherent Russian nationalist opera. In 1821, Karl Marie von Weber's Freischütz was premiered in Germany and became the prototype of a German national opera. A few decades later, Glinka, after having studied in Milan and Berlin, returned to his native land and produced two operas that laid the foundation for a real Russian opera, A Life for the Tsar and Ruslan and Ludmilla. A Life for the Tsar from 1836 became a national heroic opera, Ruslan and Ludmila from 1842 established the Russian National School of Opera, leading to Dargomishki and his theories about truth and art, which meant emphasizing Russian language declamation in opera, and opening the way for the Mighty Five, a group of Russian nationalist composers including Rimsky-Korsakov, Mussorgsky, Balakirev, and Borodin, and reaching past them to Tchaikovsky and, another composer on our program tonight, Stravinsky, a composer who obviously drenched himself in Russian folk song. Glinka took the plot from a story of this opera from a story by Pushkin, the father of Russian literature. The story concerns Ludmila, princess of pagan Russia, who disappears and is sought by three suitors, the knights Ruslan and Farlov, and the Tartar prince Ratmir. Ludmila's hand, according to the decree of the king, her father, is to be bestowed upon him who finds her and brings her home. The knight Ruslan rescues Ludmila from her captor, the magician Chernomor, but their homeward journey is intercepted by Farlov, who casts upon Ruslan a magic slumber and returns with Ludmila to claim her as his bride. Of course, Ruslan awakes and arrives just in time to become Ludmila's true prince. In Ruslan, Glinka incorporated not only Russian folk melodies, but also Finnish, Tartar, Persian, and others. Folk songs represent Ruslan's Russia, while whole-tone harmonies depict the magical world of the sorcerer Chernomor. Glinka was apparently the first composer to use a whole-tone scale, 7 notes, each a whole tone, apart. He and his successors used other non-Western scale patterns as the basis of their music, presaging what would happen in France with Claude Debussy at the end of the century. The overture begins abruptly, bursting forth with an exuberant motto in winds and timpani, connected by the strings playing the fast, furious Russian scales, so much a feature of subsequent colorful, festive, heroic music such as the finale of Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 4. There's a contrasting lyrical theme and a formal development section, thus rendering a sonata allegro form, Glinka's nod to his German training. To open this all-Russian concert is given by the Temple University Symphony Orchestra, led by their artistic director Andreas Delfs. We will hear the overture to Ruslan and Ludmila by Mikhail Glinka. Thank you. on tonight's Celebrating Our Musical Future, week two of shining the spotlight on Temple University and the Boyer College of Music and Dance. And tonight, we feature a concert given just last October 5th at the Temple Performing Arts Center on North Broad Street in Philadelphia. The Temple University Symphony Orchestra, led by their artistic director and conductor Andreas Delfs, an all-Russian program. And we begin with the curtain raiser, the Overture to Ruslan and Ludmilla by Mikhail Glinka. Music now of Rachmaninoff, which will feature a young soloist. Upon his graduation from the St. Petersburg Conservatory in 1881, Rachmaninoff was awarded the coveted gold medal and was prepared to launch a brilliant career as a concert pianist specializing in the romantic works of Schumann, Liszt, Chopin, the Russian school, and himself. Throughout his career, Rachmaninoff was never attracted to the avant-garde, preferring to remain a decided post-romantic. Thus, even though this Rhapsody for Piano and Orchestra was premiered by the composer himself in 1934, it represents the harmonic and emotional vocabulary of 50 years earlier. The source of the material, in fact, goes back over a century, taken from the last of Niccolo Paganini's 24 Caprices, Opus 1 for solo violin, a theme that Paganini had used as the basis for 11 virtuosic variations. Paganini was the prototype of the 19th century virtuoso, combining an aura of mystery and charm, of personality with dazzling feats of technical brilliance. Such was his wizardry on the violin that violinists made no real attempt to emulate him. How could they? Instead, it was the pianists who took up the challenge, attempting to transfer some of Paganini's magic to the keyboard. Significantly, Schumann, Liszt, and Brahms had all based compositions on this particular theme of Paganini. Rachmaninoff is at the end of an illustrious line of composers who have mined this material. As with Paganini, a certain legendary status surrounded Rachmaninoff, the concert virtuoso. His technique and musicality were unparalleled, and in the words of Edward Downes, he made a striking physical impression on the stage, tall, almost gaunt, with a somber, unbending, unsmiling dignity, totally absorbed in his powerful projection of the music at hand. Rachmaninoff does not present the Paganini theme immediately. It is preceded by an 8-bar introduction and a variation in which only the tonic dominant skeleton of the theme is given, much in the manner of the variations on the finale of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. For the next several variations, Rachmaninoff keeps the melodic contour and tempo of the theme intact. With variation 7, however, he bows to the tradition of demonic virtuosity and the spirit of his romantic precursors, notably Berlioz and Liszt, by adding the Dies Irae, Day of Wrath, Gregorian chant from the Requiem, into the texture. As the variations go, Rachmaninoff begins to treat Paganini's harmonic and phrase structure quite freely. Throughout the course of the variations, much is made of the major-minor shifts. There's a modulation away from and back to the tonic home key, and there are virtuosic cadenzas, as in a concerto. In this regard, the memory of Liszt is never far away. There's also drastic changes in tempo and style to suggest a multi-movement symphonic work, a Hungarian minuet, a scherzando, to which the playful theme lends itself perfectly, and a slow lyrical section exemplified by Variation 18, the most famous and popular one, containing a gorgeous melody based on the inversion of the opening theme that seemingly only someone with Russian blood could write. After disguising the material in the manner of Brahms's character variations and providing extreme contrasts, Rachmaninoff returns in the end to the original contour, tempo, and key. As the work nears its close, the piano writing becomes ever more brilliant, and for the dazzling conclusion, the Dies Irae chant melody returns to combine with the main theme. Our soloist in Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini is 20-year-old Huiping Cai, one of the most exciting young talents coming from China. Winner of numerous national and international competitions, she captured first prize, best concerto award, and best recital award at the 2017 Philadelphia International Piano Competition. She won the 2017 Temple University Concerto Competition and 2018 Miami Music Festival Competition, and was the only pianist selected in the final round of the Philadelphia Orchestra's 2017 Greenfield Concerto Competition. Her performances have been highly praised for their lyricism, musicality, as well as formidable technique. Charismatic and popular with audiences in both recital and concerto settings since she came to the U.S. back in 2016. And she is the soloist once again in the Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini by Sergei Rachmaninoff, along with the Temple University Symphony Orchestra, led by Andreas Delfs. Thank you.
Thank you.
On tonight's Celebrating Our Musical Future, we once again feature Temple University, the Boyer College of Music and Dance, and tonight a concert given by the Temple University Symphony Orchestra, led by their artistic director and conductor Andreas Delfs, recorded back on October 5th at the Temple Performing Arts Center on North Broad Street in Philadelphia. We've just heard Sergei Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. Our soloist, the 20-year-old Temple University Boyer College of Music student, Huiping Tsai. The Rachmaninoff work was premiered in 1934, but our final work seems so much further down the musical spectrum than what Rachmaninoff gave us in his wonderful showpiece for piano and orchestra. After the 1889 Paris exhibition, for which the Eiffel Tower was constructed, Paris became an extraordinary international center for culture that would help define the avant-garde in the 20th century. One musical aspect of the exhibition, aside from the appearance of a Javanese gamelan, the sound of which struck Debussy so forcibly, was the appearance of Russian musicians who became allied with the French in an attempt to ward off the German musical dangers of Wagnerism. Exotic scales, colorful orchestration, native folk tunes, intelligible declamation of Russian text and Russian legends and fairy tales were all part of the Russian exotic, non-German style, the operas of Sergei Dargomishki and the music of the mighty handful we mentioned before, Rimsky-Korsakov being one of those. In 1908, Sergei Diaghilev brought his dance ensemble, the Ballet Russe, to Paris. Such celebrated dancers as Vaslav Nijinsky, Anna Pavlova, Tamara Kasavina, plus choreographer Mikhail Fokine were part of this troupe, which had an illustrious run of 2 decades from 1909 to Diaghilev's death in 1929. Diaghilev commissioned works from a number of composers then working in Paris, not only 10 pieces from Igor Stravinsky, but scores from Prokofiev and Satie, Defia, Ravel, Debussy, and others. Artists who worked as scenic and costume designers for the company include Marc Chagall, Edouard Manet, and Pablo Picasso. Stravinsky's scores for the Ballet Russe included The Firebird in 1910, Petrushka the next year, and The Rite of Spring of the notorious premiere in 1913. These ballets, which by now considered classics, are all large-scale works from Stravinsky's Russian period, which ended with the events of World War I and the Russian Revolution of 1917. Stravinsky, from an aristocratic family, found he couldn't go home again. The action of Petrushka takes place in the 1830s in St. Petersburg during Butter Week. One eats as many pastries and everything else as possible before Lent, or this festival as we know it, Carnival. The setting is a puppet show. The ballet opens with a crowd scene in the manner of Schumann's Carnival Opus 9, or a stage set from a French grand opera. Included are an organ grinder, a dancing girl, street musicians, and drunken revelers, a kaleidoscope succession of events and musical ideas. In the score, Stravinsky quotes and elaborates on several Russian folk tunes that would immediately have been recognized, French songs and Viennese waltzes. With the folk song, Stravinsky used authentic techniques of dissonance, metric irregularity, and heterophony. Announced by two drummers, a puppeteer and a flute animates his puppets into doing a frantic, angular Russian dance. The puppet, Petrushka, a Russian harlequin from Commedia dell'arte, or what Stravinsky called the immortal and unhappy hero of every fair in all countries, is suffering because of his unrequited love for the puppet ballerina and from his self-perceived ugliness. Another puppet, the blackamoor, dances a waltz with the ballerina. Here, Stravinsky's music imitates the strumming sounds of a balalaika ensemble. The blackamoor, according to the designer for the Ballet Russe, Alexandre Benoit, is the embodiment of everything senselessly attractive, powerfully masculine, and undeservedly triumphant. Petrushka tries to interrupt, but to no avail. He is harshly rejected. This may represent the early 20th century feeling of alienation of the sensitive individual, and more specifically of the artist, from society. Stravinsky was himself an artist working far from his native Russia. Yet he did not write sentimental music for this score. After all, these were puppets, and Stravinsky said that Petrushka only becomes real in death. Stravinsky also revealed that the colorful music made him think of the smells of Russian food and of sweet and glistening old boot. In this work, however, he decidedly moved away from the lush romantic orchestration into harsh stridency and lack of tenderness. Much of the score, while very colorfully orchestrated, is decidedly cool and mechanical, precisely like much of Stravinsky's music of the next two decades, usually termed neoclassical. Even though he uses here a huge orchestra with double woodwinds and an expanded battery of percussion, in addition to piano and celesta. For Stravinsky, the piano was a central purveyor of neoclassical style and was treated as such in a non-romantic manner, almost as a percussion instrument. This becomes evident in the many pieces he wrote using that instrument in the 1920s. At the fair are heard a series of characteristic dances. The Bluto-like blackamoor and Petrushka burst on the scene fighting, and Petrushka is fatally stabbed with the blackamoor's scimitar. The puppeteer tries to make the crowd realize that Petrushka was only a doll, but his ghost then appears, mocking them for their naivete. The music ends on an unresolved dissonance of C and the F sharp, the two root notes of the Petrushka chord. These roots are a tritone apart, the old devil in music interval, as far apart as two notes can be in the 12-tone scale. It is Petrushka thumbing his nose at the crowd. The score is a catalog of a number of early 20th century tonal practices, ranging from diatonicism to whole tone-based chords, chord clusters, modal harmonies, and chromatic alteration. Stravinsky began composing Petrushka in the summer of 1910 and completed the score on the 26th of May, 1911. He worked closely with Benoit, who had previously written the scenario for The Firebird. Petrushka was premiered by Diaghilev and the Ballet Russe in Paris at the Théâtre du Châtelet on the 13th of June, 1911, the choreography by Mikhail Fokine, and with Nijinsky dancing the title role. Pierre Monteux, who also conducted the premiere of Rite of Spring in 1913, led the orchestra. In keeping with the mechanical puppet-like music of the score, Stravinsky originally planned it as a piano concerto, with the piano representing Petrushka, his part, as Stravinsky said, characterized by diabolical cascades of arpeggios, and the orchestra, in turn, retaliates with menacing trumpet blasts. The ballet score was difficult for the dancers, mostly because of the rapidly changing accented patterns of Stravinsky's music, something even further developed in The Rite of Spring. Furthermore, the scenery took up a large part of the stage, even restricting the dancers' movements. Nijinsky was, by all accounts, brilliant, not just as an athletic acrobat, but in probing Petrushka's soul with his facial expressions. After seeing him dance this role, Sarah Bernhardt supposedly exclaimed, I am afraid because I have just seen the greatest actor in the world." In 1947, Stravinsky revised the music of Petrushka, linking the four tableaux with drum interludes, reorchestrating certain passages, and adding contrapuntal lines. Program notes there by Stephen Willier. We will hear the 1947 Petrushka here, the first tableau, the Shrovetide Fair, the magic trick and Russian dance, the second tableau, Petrushka's room, third tableau, the Moor's room, dance of the ballerina waltz, and the fourth tableau, the Shrovetide Fair, toward evening, dance of the nursemaids, dance of the coachmen and stable boys, and the murmurs. Petrushka by Igor Stravinsky, performed here by the Temple University Symphony Orchestra, led by their artistic director and conductor, Andreas Delfs. Thank you.
Thank you.
conclude this concert, an all-Russian concert given by the Temple University Symphony Orchestra back on October 5th, recorded in the Temple Performing Arts Center on North Broad Street in Philadelphia. On tonight's Celebrating Our Musical Future, where we shine the spotlight on Temple University Boyer College of Music and Dance, we've heard Petrushka, the 1947 version of the ballet by Igor Stravinsky, the Temple University Symphony Orchestra led by their artistic director and conductor, Andreas Delfs. If you want to find out more information about Boyer College of Music and Dance, you can simply visit temple.edu/Boyer. You also might want to check out the recordings, the Grammy-nominated recordings of the Temple Ensembles when you go to that website. The label is BCMND, Boyer College Music and Dance Records. Number of people to thank for making these broadcasts from Temple University possible. We want to thank the Dean of Boyer College Music and Dance, Dr. Robert T. Stroker, Stephen Willier for his very fine program notes, and David Passbrig, who engineered tonight's recording. I also want to send out a special thanks to Linda Fiore. With the time we have remaining, we're going to hear some selections from a faculty recital given at Temple University Boyer College of Music and Dance last February with two incredible musicians who listeners to the Classical Network know very well because we hear them often. Celebrating Our Musical Future is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.